Welcome to Telling Tales, a program devoted to the spoken word. I'm Ms. G. Today, poet Emily Wall, assistant professor of English at the University of Alaska Southeast, reads selections from her book, Live Aboard, published by Salmon Poetry, and offers thoughts on poetry as an art form. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the words of poet Emily Wall.
I started writing poetry when I was 14 and bored in a math class, and I've been writing ever since. But I got serious about it when I was an undergrad at Colby College and studying poetry with the poet Iris Sadoff. The best poems, I think, come from writers who I feel like are expressing things that I have thought but not thought of as a thought yet, if that makes sense. Particularly poems by like Mary Oliver or Iris Sadoff, they'll say something and as I read it, I think, that's exactly how I feel or that's exactly what that experience is like. So it gives voice to things that we maybe haven't given voice to ourselves before. When I come into a classroom and see my students for the first time, the first thing I tell them is that this is a place to experiment, to play. This is not a place where we're trying to impress each other or impress ourselves. This is a learning place, and that really helps us. It frees us up to make mistakes, to experiment, to take advice from each other, and that's really important in the classroom. Is poetry an academic thing or an emotional thing? I don't really see those as diametrically opposed, I guess. It's both. For me, it's an academic thing because it's my job, and I believe that there's a lot of good poetry that comes out of academic thinking about it and writing about it. But poetry has to be come from a region very close to the heart, or it's not going to be anything worth reading. I have no patience for poems that are academic exercises or all about language or showing off. Poetry needs to come from somewhere inside of us to mean anything. The poems I'm going to be reading are from my book titled Live Aboard, which came out with the Irish Press Salmon Poetry. And these poems were written while I was living aboard my Tana 37 sailboat down in Vancouver. I lived aboard for 4 years and sailed and cruised around the coast of British Columbia and Washington. And the poems really deal with issues of living aboard, living with the natural world, living in those kinds of communities. This poem is called Saturday Morning. Sometimes we just want to cut our bodies away from the dock, shake out our aching sails, close our eyes, hands on the wheel, and yes, yes, in wind. It doesn't matter if we go upriver or down, if we see seals or silver salmon, if we get lost in the back eddies, if we get sung out to sea. Every nerve in our necks thrums down our spines until even our cramped hands begin to hum, threaten to break into pale sea stars, indigo blossoms. This next poem is called Live Aboard. Multiple poems in the collection are called Live Aboard as I'm exploring different cycles and different themes in the book, issues of faith, issues of living in the community, living in the natural world. And this one is about living on the dock. We lived in a marina called Shelter Island Marina on the Fraser River, and it was an incredibly interesting community to live in, sort of like being back in college in a dorm. We all shared a mail room and a pub at the top of the dock and bathrooms, and so we got to know each other really well. And on our dock, there was a big flat space where we created a community garden. We used to hang out there together and have parties and stuff. And so this poem is about that dock. Live Aboard. The most beautiful garden in the world is a dock garden. At the foot of the ramp on B Dock, Cheryl has created a utopia of potted plants. Tendrils climb the power pole. Vines cover the sign that warns us of electric current. There are hanging plants on all the pilings that go up and down and up again. She waters at high tide when the hanging pots are waist high. There are cherry tomatoes, and we help ourselves as we pass on the way to our boats, sweetness bursting on our tongues as we walk down the wooden dock. Almost all of us have small gardens, too, a few pots of straw flowers or pansies. Tony, living in his float home, has flowers that attract hummingbirds. A mallard pair uses a pot of petunias on Lorna's dock as a nest. Each evening we gather around to admire the 5 creamy eggs, and when they hatch, the ducks are born right into the soil and pop out of the plant one by one as we watch. Even the woman on the other Tayana, who we met in Montague Harbor, who is heading out for a cruise around the world, has an herb garden in tiny pots attached to her cockpit rail. She dug up her favorite plants from their sprawling house and is taking them with her despite her husband's irritation. The boat is offshore ready, outfitted with $10,000 of electronics. Hull and deck are perfect, but she cannot give up a small patch of soil with her thyme and mint and sage. Even though we live on water, we all keep a small patch of earth near us and dig our fingers into it each evening, smelling the soil on our hands, catching it under our nails before we step on board to sleep on nothing more substantial than water in a fast river current. This next poem is for Joni, who lived a few boats from us on the dock and drowned in the second year that we lived there. And it's called Sleeping in Sharon's Wake. The Sharon in the title refers to the Sharon of the River Styx. Sleeping in Sharon's Wake. Some things always wake us. A tug coming in at 3 a.m., prop boiling the water like a boat crossing the Styx, our own boat slamming the dock in the wake. I open my eyes and see powerful sodium lights shining into the hatch over my head, hear shouts as the tug fights the current and a man leaps to the dock to get a wrap around a cleat. And other things don't wake us. Joni, eating at the pub on steak and prawn night, drinking her usual bottle of wine, slips coming down the dock, slips into the cool green river next to her own boat, which must have rocked a little in the wake of her body. What are the secret weapons of poetry? I think the secret weapons are many. For me, I use a couple things in particular. I think narrative is really important for poetry, telling stories. A lot of times I think we think that you're either a storyteller or a poet, and that's not true. Poems can tell stories. And I also think metaphor is incredibly powerful. It's a form of creation and transformation. To compare two things that are unlike creates a new third thing, and that's, in my mind, a true act of creation. Not simply using images or language to describe something, but to make something wholly new. And I think the best metaphors are able to create an idea of how we're feeling. It sort of puts words to something that's hard to name, that's hard to identify, by using an image. When I lived in Vancouver, I lived in a marina that was on the Fraser River. The Fraser River is actually an estuary. The Strait of Georgia tides up into the river. Because of that, the Fraser River Delta is a major habitat for migratory birds. Several million shorebirds pass over this estuary annually, and tens of thousands remain every winter. A lot of the poems in this book explore the intimacy of living in such close proximity to these birds. This is called Permission. There are three nesting pairs of geese on the river this spring. Last night we watched them swimming for the island. One pair had seven goslings strung out like pearls between the clasps of them. A second pair had one between them, their shadow a small mountain range. The final pair had none. They swam to the island with the others as if teaching young geese to swim. Their loss was strung in space across river water, and everyone on the dock discussed the taking of goslings by the pair of eagles who hunt here all year. I know this is right, this is good. The eagles do not need our permission to eat. But I see now that I am too much in the house of the mind to listen to the unpermissioned needs of the body. How will I change enough to celebrate the full bellies of wild eagles? This next poem is a modified extended haiku. The idea with an extended haiku poem is that each stanza exists on its own as a standalone haiku, but together they build a larger picture. This one has been modified that I've created two stanzas that are haikus and then a couplet that follows that, and I've done that three times in the poem. And this is about a great blue heron. Great blue haiku. Here you come. I love your swinging hips wide as a woman's feathered thighs. But landing, you shrug your shining shoulders like an absent-minded priest. Could this really be you, blue Madonna of the river? You begin fishing, stepping to the hunger of your hallowed belly, stalking the rich weeds and the trance, a prayer we have all memorized. But now you open your wings, fling water like coins, careless. Who are you? We read the river daily. We learn the catechism of you, holy bird, blue shape of the soul, a door opening for us. But now you rise with a shriek, a cry from some other world, where beauty cannot be transcribed onto our hearts as religious texts, where memorizing the verse of your feeding dance cannot feed our own flightless desires. What's left? The empty altar of grass. Do I think poems are better read out loud or read to themselves? I think both is excellent, actually. They're different experiences. I think when you're sitting alone in your armchair reading a poem, you have a very intimate connection to that poem. You hear it in your head, you have your own images, and I think you create a relationship with that poem, and it becomes yours in that way. But I also love hearing poets read, and oftentimes the poem will change for me when I hear a poet read. They'll emphasize certain things, they will conjure up images I may not have seen before. An introduction to a poem can change the way we understand a poem. So I really love both. I like reading it myself first, and then I love hearing poets read their work. We spend a lot of time talking about poetry in class. My students are great for helping me understand and think about poetry. They really challenge me and challenge the way that I think about the craft. This poem explores the recent phenomenon of teenagers setting off to break world records sailing. Tanya Abey did it first when she was in her early 20s. She sailed solo around the world in a 21-foot boat. And this past year, a teenager from New Zealand named Jessica Watson became the youngest person to sail unassisted around the world. She was 16 when she completed her circumnavigation. So this poem is written for her. Crossing Desire. Perhaps you are a fool. Or maybe, like an Arctic tern, it's all about long distances for you. Perhaps you have unloving parents, as everyone says. Or maybe you are the albatross, simply able and willing to go without stopping. I hope for your sake it's not about the record, the youngest to circumnavigate. I think you'll write a book about how you found yourself out on the wide waters, the last frontier of our collective minds. But I imagine, like Tanya Abey, you'll be in all the magazines, and you and your racing boat will become the images of our armchair desires for a while. And then there's divorce, lost children, a wandering in the desert for many years, because where else is there to go now? I hope that won't be true. I hope you'll be able to find another frontier or two, another ocean to cross, and you'll be able to live the years by planning and dreaming as we are meant to do. One of the cycles in this book is what I call the Eve poems, and I'm referring to the biblical Eve here, that first woman, the only woman who lived in the Garden of Eden. And these poems explore that first woman's relationship to the natural world, and they also tie into the concept that we have of Eden, that sort of first lost garden. Sailors in particular, I think, are a little obsessed with Eden because we're always looking for that perfect gunghole, the perfect marina, the perfect harbor that no one else is in. It's kind of this obsession of returning to that first place. Eve becoming. As I flip through the Sibley guide, looking up a duck who arrives with a splash, I wonder about Eve. Did she learn from Adam the name Northern Pintail? Was she taking notes as he said mallard, blackbird? Or did the birds tell her, as Adam checked them off his life list, winging over her head, look at me, my loose bones of flight, their names just opening on the wet tongue of her heart, and suddenly she knew them like she knew everything. This is a goose. This quiet place by the river Tigris is mine, and my name is Eve. Recognize me. Eve sailing. When she wakes, beside her cupped palm is a leaf, a green dory with ribs, a stem, a rudder. It's rocking in the soft morning wind. Just beyond is a white feather, a bit of down from a northern gannet who crosses the ocean in just 5 days. A white sail bellied, ready. Eve closes her eyes and slippers her body into this cupped, rocking space, the closest she'll ever come to a womb. She holds the sides, presses her face to the wind, and feels her body lift across the water, that pull and tug of body, boat, wind, desire. If she doesn't open her eyes, she could sail all the way across Eden. If she doesn't open her eyes, she could imagine a mother for herself. Imagine sailing between two warm thighs and out into the light of a world where she is not the only woman, where she is not the only one who doesn't have the power to create. Eve in Eden. It must have taken a long time, this work of naming. Every day animals must have passed through your garden. A flash of blue during dinner and a reminder that work is to be done. Did you sit back on your hands, legs out, while Adam said, peacock, lemur, horned toad? Did you think of asking God as he walked in the garden with you that evening about naming a few yourself? Did you try out names on your tongue, rolling delicious vowels in your mouth? Did you hear Adam say leopard and think, what a prosaic name that was? That surely you could have done better. Names. Violet-crowned, Berylin, Broad-tailed, Cinnamon, Calliope. Hummingbird names unfurl on the tongue like a curl of butter, melting into the body's memory of hunger and flight, and the name we carried like feathers before we arrived in this world and weighted ourselves with solid bones, classified as accountant, homeowner, parent, minivan, soccer practice, diabetes, overweight, suburbia. Remember being ruby-throated? I almost do.
You're listening to Telling Tales, today featuring poet Emily Wall, reading selections from her book, Live Aboard.
When we lived in Vancouver, we spent summers cruising the Washington and BC coasts, and we particularly loved the Gulf Islands and Desolation Sound. The next two poems deal with cruising and Desolation Sound. Captain Vancouver named this amazing place Desolation because it was remote and forbidding. And I love the irony of that name because it's this beautiful, warm spot. The water there is incredibly warm, and it has all of this marine life. And it's a really popular cruising spot. Hundreds of boats go there every summer. It's interesting how our ideas of desolation and Eden change over the centuries. Grace Harbor, Desolation Sound. When we wake the next morning and look over the side to chuck the anchor, jellies, jellies, jellies. The water around us is a thick carpet of moon jellies, each little orb pulsing, rising and falling in the tide swell. Even though we know better, we can't help stretching out our hands, reaching down. Who could resist touching the moon if it came down in its thousand little bodies and surrounded us? Sometimes we need to be chosen. Sometimes we need for belief to be out of our hands. This next poem is about the only community in Desolation Sound. It's called Refuge Cove, and it's basically laundry facilities and a shower and a little store, but it's a meeting place for everybody there. This poem is also a ghazal, which is an ancient Persian form. I've been experimenting with different forms in this book. I have a couple sestinas, some extended haiku, and this ghazal. So in this form, it's composed of a number of couplets, and each couplet has to completely stand alone. It can't connect to the one before or after it. But together, they have to build the whole poem. The only connection between them is that the last word of each couplet has to be the exact same word. In this one, I've used the word boat. Ghazal for Refuge Cove. A long, splintered dock, some cleats on floats, holding fast our lines three deep, dinghies, yachts, boats. Shower floor, rich with steam and swirls of hair, relief. Skin breathing again, thighs gleaming, boats. When you stern tide, do you loop back around? Thick beard, canvas shoes, rich smell of mildew on his live-aboard boat. Otters under rotting boards grind crab shells in their teeth, ravenous, littering the water with sharp shells of boat. Outside the harbor, wind beats the strait. Water sleeves up into spray, long schooners of salt coat the decks of entering boats. We knock fresh beers, welcome new arrivals, store closes at 6. Long sun slanting through harbor entrance, making new the battered boats. Tinker with the depth sounder, red numbers flash as tide rises, then falls. New tendrils of algae caress the keel, backbone of boat. Mandolin music, three boats over and an accordion joins in. We sip chilled wine, raise our glasses when they walk by our reeling boats. tied fast, deep sleep, no one on watch tonight, except the moon floating on the thousand wavelets, traveling the length of this sweet, temporary home. The next few poems explore our relationship to God and how we try to find our footing in this whole idea of faith, how we live on the water, how we live in our communities with the natural world, and how we live with our belief systems. Communion. In November, deep storms come, rising the river into sheets of white, vestments lifting in wind. The boat heels over. I wake, roll out of my berth, walk quietly into the galley, and light the stove. It takes a while. Alcohol, kerosene, just the right amount of knob turning and breath holding. It feels a little like morning matins, this ritual. I put on the old percolator, and the singing gurgle of the pot is a quiet chorus starting up. Nobody makes coffee this way anymore. I stand and watch, make sure the pot doesn't slide off the stove in a fresh gust of wind. Out the porthole I see tangled waves, the ruffled feathers of a passing duck. Inside, the darkness smells rich as incense. I pour coffee into a silver thermos, wrap myself in an old quilt and ease up on deck, where I can see our whole stretch of river, grasses bowing deeply. I touch the coffee to my lips, say amen. This is the real communion of the heart. Here on the wild river, living this ritual day after day, my mouth and hands at the center of the way I can know God. Navigating faith. If heaven was in the North Country, the voice of God calling us home would be Canada geese, wild arrows showing us the way, reminding us as they pass over our working bodies that this is where we too will go. Now in a heavy rain, as they pass above us singing their hymn of holy highways, we look up, watch the wake of their bodies cutting through thick clouds, and the clear direction they offer us this morning makes it easy. Of course I'll follow them, up into the north mountains of mist and spruce, up to a God who loves our heavy, feathered bodies. Eve, finally. For a while, perfection was easy. We seemed to think it was our due, this sweetness, this garden, where every morning I would walk, brushing my hands along the feathery heads of wild grass to relieve them of their dew. This was the way I washed my hands every morning, baptizing each finger awake. But then, walking in the evenings with Adam and Yahweh, I began to feel something gathering, coming. I began to see the shadows and the fallen grasses. Sometimes I walked behind them, listened to the rumble of their talk, and it sounded like thunder just beyond the next hill. I began to look for lightning. For what perfection can last forever? I know now we're not made to live in an unspoiled world. I can't imagine heaven. All I want is to hold Abel in my arms, and for a glimpse again of the wild grasses, sweetly wet and new. This poem tells the story of a couple we met while we were out cruising. One of the real pleasures of cruising is meeting other cruisers and exchanging stories and information. This is especially sweet if you have similar boats. We pulled into this little marina in the Gulf Islands, and this couple had the exact same boat we had, so we're pretty excited to talk to each other. Sailing to Seventh Heaven. We dropped the hook in Montague Harbor, this sweet corner of the Gulf Islands, pop open two beers and look around, taking stock of the other boats. And there is another Tejana exactly like ours, only with a blue hull and newer sails. Within minutes, a dinghy rushes over from their boat to ours. The skipper invites us over to see his boat, to meet his wife, to see how he's outfitted for an ocean crossing. They just retired, just finished refitting, and are headed out this week for a life beyond. We dinghy to their beautiful boat and find ourselves in awe of the work they have done. Everything on our life list already finished on their gleaming yacht. His wife makes us tea and shows me the stacked linens, the small herb garden she is growing in pots hanging on the cockpit rail. He shows Corey the electronic cockpit, the new diesel engine. Then she shows me the small urn containing her cat's remains. She died the week we packed up, and I just couldn't leave her behind, she tells me, and starts to cry. This is all his idea. He sold our house. I touch her arm, look at her perfect boat, listen to her cry about her grandchildren. Down in the stern, he shows Corey his new navigation system, his new weather station. He's prepared for anything. He's been saving his entire life for this. The next day, they visit our boat, and as I show her the way I've organized the lockers, our cat wanders in, and she bursts into tears, holds and holds the cat. Please let me take her, she begs, this woman I've met yesterday. She strokes and strokes Tio's head. I'm sorry, I say, I'm sorry. We sit on the floor of the boat, and I hold her hand, this woman about to cross an ocean with a man she calls him. I think they will make it to Hawaii, and she'll leave him, and he'll have to sell the boat, one of hundreds who have done this, who have spent years building their dream, and then abandon it in paradise, return to the suburbs without anything to plan for, to dream about. And every visit from a grandchild will have to be perfect. Every flower she grows will have to be worth thousands of dollars, a lifetime of hopes and wishes. Corey and I watch them dinghy back to their boat, he facing forward, she facing back, their bodies soon lost in the blinding light of the setting sun. When we were living in Vancouver, we would cruise every summer all around the coast, and at the end of the summer, we would go back to the Gulf Islands and spend a couple nights there before we crossed the strait and returned back to the city and our work there. I'm fascinated by the idea of returning, that most of us find some way to escape from the lives we've chosen and presumably want to live, and then we escape into these places that for us are a way of escaping from our lives, and they're often natural places, places in the natural world that we connect with. Leaving the islands. I want to slice thin layers of skin and leave them here on Galliano, drying on rocks in Montague Harbor. I want to take the peeled bark from an arbutus on Thetis Island, weave it between my fingers, make sea stars. I want to drink salt water, turn my hair into a new species of kelp. I want to float between trees over the forest floor, smelling cedar, 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 listening to woodpeckers, gray jays, one owl swimming in air. I want never to move out of my body.
You've been listening to Telling Tales, today featuring poet Emily Wall, reading selections from her book, Live Aboard, published by Salmon Poetry. Emily is an assistant professor of English at the University of Alaska Southeast. This program was produced by Jeff Brown in the studios of KTOO-FM in Juneau, Alaska. I'm Ms. G. Thanks for tuning in.